Does a federal agent have absolute immunity in an ICE raid? Who gets to take the field? Who gets to carry a gun? Who gets to drop a bomb? You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We have got a lot of interesting legal issues to talk about today. Before we get started, though, I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that many of the topics that we'll cover in today's conversation are deeply personal. We break them down into their intricate legal questions to help us understand what's happening in the courts, but never to minimize what's happening in our lives. Let's start here. Federal prosecutors in Minnesota have resigned over pressures to investigate the widow of Renee Good. Good is the woman fatally shot by an ICE agent last week. Minnesota lawmakers are pushing for an investigation into the conduct of the officer who killed Good. We'll turn today to Mike Thompson. He's one of our analysts we go to often to understand legal issues of our day, especially those in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. I talked with him about federal law enforcement action and various cases in front of the court in January. He is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls, and he stopped by the SDPB studios earlier this week. I want to play a little clip of Vice President J.D. Vance after the shooting in Minneapolis that killed Renee Good, talking about this concept of a federal officer having, quote, absolute immunity.
First of all, I wish the state officials in Minnesota would investigate why you have so many people who are using their vehicles and other means to actually interfere with a legitimate law enforcement operation. The precedent here is very simple. You have a federal law enforcement official engaging in federal law enforcement action. That's a federal issue. That guy is protected by absolute immunity. He was doing his job. The idea.
So as we unpack what happened in Minneapolis, what are some of the main questions you're hearing people ask about that shooting and what happens next?
Right.
And how do you want to address some of those? Where would you like to begin?
I think I want to begin with the question about whether that ICE officer, being a federal governmental employee and law enforcement officer, could be prosecuted by a state if his actions do amount to a murder or a manslaughter or some other sort of crime. So, and we've talked before about the Federal Tort Claims Act on your show. The Federal Tort Claims Act waives the sovereign immunity of the United States in certain circumstances. But that doesn't subject the individual officer to consequences. That subjects the United States to consequences based on the officer's conduct. So there are two exceptions to that waiver of immunity, one of which is the discretionary function. Oftentimes uses of force are viewed by the courts as being a use of discretion, the officer's power to make a choice. And often that's how the U.S. avoids liability. That's how the U.S. continues to enjoy sovereign immunity. There's another law enforcement exception that's also in the Federal Tort Claims Act that allows you to sue the United States if for false arrest, a bad seizure, those kinds of things. So there might be some action against the United States that the family could take seeking money for the officer's wrongful actions. The
civil or criminal?
That'd be civil.
That'd be civil from the family. Civil. That's possible. Okay.
So the family's got at least a monetary avenue based on what the officer's actions were. The other thing is the Supreme Court in 1890 decided a case in the matter of Neagle, N-E-A-G-L-E, that said that a state could not prosecute a federal law enforcement officer who committed an act essentially in the course and scope of his employment. So that case has existed as good law since 1890. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court more recently talked about it in the context of the Federal Tort Claims Act. But that Neagle case said that as long as that officer is within, essentially, the scope and course of his employment, he cannot be prosecuted by the state, which leaves open the question of, okay, what if he's operating outside of the scope and course of his employment? What if he engages in an objectively unreasonable use of force? Mm-hmm. Could he now be prosecuted? And that's the open question. So I think it's possible, depending on what the facts ultimately show about his use of force, whether Minnesota could prosecute him.
But doesn't Minnesota have to have access to, there should be some kind of discovery, and right now the FBI is not giving them that.
Right, that's true.
So are they just done, or is there a potential in the future to piece together enough to proceed with the case, they decide to?
Yeah, I think there's potential in the future to get a hold of that information, especially if the family starts a lawsuit mm-hmm. under the Federal Tort Claims Act, then that discovery would have to be made in that lawsuit.
It seems like there is a lot of public evidence right. about this shooting.
Right.
Not everybody agrees on what that evidence shows, but that's what a court of law is for.
Yep, that's exactly what a court of law is for.
Yeah. How surprised were you to hear so many people saying it's this or it's this before it went through any kind of process of, like, speak a little bit to this idea of, I mean, that's politics. I don't need to get you to get into politics, but the idea of what the courts are for, to unpack these things, apply the law carefully and judiciously.
Right. It seems to happen in every use of force case. In South Dakota, for example, if an officer uses lethal force, someone dies, then the Division of Criminal Investigation investigates it, determines mm-hmm. the constitutionality of the use of force. But the court is there to determine, like you say, whether that use of force was objectively reasonable. That's the constitutional standard. Because it's a Fourth Amendment situation. She was seized lethally, and the Fourth Amendment says those seizures have to be reasonable. He doesn't have absolute immunity, which means I don't even have to respond to any complaint or anything. I'm just out. It isn't like qualified immunity isn't going to be relevant in this case because that's a 1983 concept when you sue a state officer.
Okay.
Unless there comes out some fact that he was acting, and it doesn't appear to be the case, but if there's some argument that says he was acting under color of state law when he shot her, then it might be relevant. But I don't think from what I've seen so far, I don't think that's going to be an argument.
Anything else that stands out in that case before we move on that you think are interesting legal issues?
No, I think the interesting legal issue is going to be, I think Minnesota really, from what I've seen, really wants to prosecute or do something to show that its own sovereignty, it has the right to enforce its own rules when you are in its jurisdiction.
Yeah. A tragedy all around.
Yes.
But we are here to talk about some of the intricate legal issues of the case. Let's pivot now to the U.S. Supreme Court, because in January there are some headline-grabbing, very significant Supreme Court arguments.
Yes.
And there are two about transgender athletes that we heard earlier this week. Help us understand a little bit about these two cases, how they might be similar and how they might be different, and the significance of them. Where do you want to begin here?
Well, the cases are Little versus Hecox and West Virginia versus BPJ. The first legal issue is in Little versus Hecox. Well, first of all, they both deal with persons who identify as a gender different than what was biologically determined at birth. Yeah. So,
and athletes. Yeah, transgender athletes. Yeah.
They're transgender athletes. So in Hecox and West Virginia versus BPJ, those states had passed laws preventing a transitioning male from participating on female athletic teams. So the Supreme Court's going to have to determine. There are two arguments in the cases. One is whether that conduct violates Title IX, which mm-hmm. is the federal statute that prohibits discrimination based on sex in educational activities, and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So those are the two legal arguments that are being made. The interesting one in Hecox, which is one you don't see very often, is she won in the lower courts. now she wants to dismiss the case. She wants to she's the winner and wants to dismiss the case because she's sick of the harassment that has come as a result of the case. So the Supreme Court has to decide, are they going to let her dismiss it? And if they let her dismiss it, then the case is moot, which means there's no justiciable.
What about the Jane Doe? There's a cisgender woman in Hickox who's basically saying this law makes it so that anybody can challenge an athlete's gender. So if you are a cisgender woman who appears to someone as being masculine or you might be really dominant on the field, they can challenge your gender.
Right.
And you have to prove that. Is the case moot for that Jane Doe as well?
It would not be moot as to the question of whether the Jane Doe has standing to contest. The Jane Doe might not have standing. But with Hickox, it would be moot unless the Supreme Court thinks that this is an issue that's capable of repetition, yet evading review. And I don't think the Supreme Court's not going to determine that it's moot. These questions are squarely in front of it right now. They've been boiling for a while around the country. I think the court's going to decide the merits of these issues. It's the other interesting thing about it is in Bostock versus Clayton, which is from 2020, that's the Title VII case, the employment law case, where Justice Gorsuch wrote for the majority that sex in the language of Title VII includes transgender status. That's the only time the court has determined that sex includes transgender status. We saw last term in Scarametti, the transgender medication case, I'll call it, where the court said, no, the distinction here is not being made based on sex. It's being based on age.
Right. The court left in place the president's transgender military ban.
Yep.
They didn't touch the passport identification, saying you had to put on your passport the gender that was on your birth certificate and the gender that was assigned to you at birth.
Right.
But there is that 2020 case which said trans folks, you can't discriminate based on on sex for trans folks.
In employment, exactly.
In employment.
So in the Bostock case, though, you've got Gorsuch, who writes the majority there, and he's joined by a couple of other Breyer and Ginsburg, who are now off the court, of course, and been replaced by Republican presidents. And in that case, you had Alito and Kavanaugh and Thomas who dissented in 2020. Mm. So now you've got, they have a pretty strong six-member, they being what people refer to as conservative members of the bench. They have a six-member majority.
So the significance of this is these are pretty big cases.
These are two very big cases, yeah. The Equal Protection Clause, if the court determines that transgender status is included as sex for equal protection purposes, then the government would have to show a compelling interest and that they're a compelling interest in regulating it this way, and that their regulation is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. It's the highest scrutiny that's available, and the government generally loses those. In Scarametti, we saw the argument that we ought to use strict scrutiny, but the court said, no, we're just going to use the lowest one, which is rational basis.
How is this playing out in colleges in South Dakota with transgender athletes?
The NCAA has some rules on transgender athletes in sports. Generally, it's biological sex, the sex assigned at birth.
And there haven't been lawsuits yet?
Not that I've seen, no.
Okay.
No. The Bostock opinion, I think, does stand in the court's way in a little bit, but it's pretty easy to distinguish it from these cases because, number one, it dealt with a completely different statutory scheme. Although Title IX and Title VII are often interpreted in the same fashion. And we also have to remember that in the Biden administration issued a number of regulations regarding Title IX that favored transgender statuses But the courts stopped the implementation of those new regulations. So now we're back to Donald Trump regulations from 2020,
okay,
which don't contain the same
the
type
The court stopped was based on what? Like what were some of the legal arguments?
I think the transgender status was part of that, but I think it was mostly based on the way the rules were enacted.
Sure.
Some procedural arguments about
that. So there
are
procedural arguments here, but also sort of sweeping cultural impact of these cases.
It's a huge impact, impact. And I always tell people that if you're interested in the Supreme Court, if you go to their website. They have a list of cases they've granted certiorari in, which means they want to hear the appeal. And if you read those grants of certiorari, a lot of times the court, in my opinion, shows its hand on how it's going to rule. And if you read the two on these two cases, it leads me to believe that the court's going to say this is not a discrimination based on sex.
Yep.
So.
Let's talk about a couple other cases that are January cases in front of the court. And how about one about Second Amendment?
Yeah, we can't go a term without a gun, I guess. Wolford versus Lopez. So in 2022, the court, in interpreting the Second Amendment, the court said we have to look at founding era rules. The government to sustain a gun regulation, the government has to show that in the founding era, the government has to show that there was a rule or rules in place at the time of the founding that were regulations like the ones the government is trying to impose today. Essentially. So it's a historical exercise.
Mm. And the argument would be if you wanted to change anything from the founding, you would need to make an amendment to the Constitution based on what Americans feel today.
Right. Yeah.
If you don't like the Second Amendment, give us another constitutional amendment.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But the founding era is a long time ago.
It's a long time ago.
A lot has some stuff has happened
right.
since then.
And in Wolford versus Lopez, you've got the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit didn't pay attention to Bruin and look back at the founding era. The Ninth Circuit looked at the history since Reconstruction, Reconstruction era,
okay,
which is an immediate flag to the present Supreme Court. And in Wolford versus Lopez, you can't carry in a public place unless the owner of the property consents. So as the court terms it, that's a presumption against carry.
Mm-hmm. Court these are cases out of Hawaii and California.
Yep, and the court doesn't like any presumption against carry. The burden of proof's on the government to show the legality of the regulation, not on the person to show that the regulation is invalid.
Okay.
So,
you can put a sign up and say no guns allowed in this private business.
You can, yeah.
But this was a law saying that you would have to put a sign up saying guns are allowed. Otherwise, you as a gun owner who's lawfully carrying has to assume that you can't take it into my business.
Right.
That was basically the idea of this.
Yeah, and the laws contain a whole bunch of squishy language, like if the public area is a sensitive area.
Mm-hmm.
And
a hospital, a library, a museum.
Right.
A beach in Hawaii.
Yep. And even though Bruin's rule is pretty squishy about what's going on in the founding era, the court doesn't like the fact that there's a presumption against gun use. It's up to the government to prove that, well, Jimmy carried a gun into a private area, into a public area without permission.
Yeah.
And then leave it up to Jimmy to show that he can't.
Any signaling from the court on this?
Yeah,
one?
This will get reversed.
Yeah.
There's a whole circuit split, the circuit courts of appeal. All the other circuits that have looked at this question have decided in favor of the government. So this one will get reversed.
Federal government.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not the state government in this
case.
Right.
No, not the state government. It's federal government.
I want to just bring up this new set of allegations of new war crimes against the Trump administration. There's some reporting in the New York Times. Help us understand perfidy.
Perfidy.
In the international law of war, what is perfidy?
It's a ruse as to identity, is the way I understand it. The claim in that the New York Times is reporting on is that the plane that bombed the Venezuela boat was disguised as a civilian aircraft.
September 2025 one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Disguised as a civilian aircraft, which would violate the terms of the Geneva Convention. It's a 1940s era Supreme Court case where the Germans landed a submarine on the East Coast, and the Germans made a point to come on shore in their uniforms, which then, if they were captured, that would give them the status of prisoners of war, and they would be entitled to protections under the Geneva Convention. If they do engage in perfidy when they come on shore and they're disguised, then they don't enjoy the protections of a prisoner of war. So that is essentially the situation here. Hmm. You're acting in what you being the United States is defining as a wartime mission, and you're disguising yourself.
Yeah.
So
you can't do that.
You cannot.
There are some circumstances where you can do certain things, but you can't do that.
You cannot. And so that does raise a legitimate question of whether that action is a war crime, in violation of the convention.
And the theory would be if you were on that ship and you saw an American warplane, you could make an attempt to swim away.
Right. Or you could make an attempt to change your conduct, or you could realize, you know, this is pretty serious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that opportunity was not given to them. According to reporting in the New York Times, which is based on some anonymous sources, we're just figuring out some of the details of this. But the word perfidy is going to be around a lot. So I think it's an important distinction, what you said about the rules of war restrain you, but they also protect you.
Right. That's the theory.
Because
that's the theory.
We're not allowed to just go around murdering each other. But in wartime, there are certain rules that govern and say, no, you're not going to be punished for this murder because you are obeying the laws of war.
Right.
And those laws of war are designed, I'm just getting my veteran's
soapbox
on, the laws of war are designed to help you return to peace when the war is over.
Right.
That's a really important distinction, I think.
Yeah, it is an important distinction. And the law of war is very relevant in this whole operation. Because Congress has significant control over the conduct of military operations. I don't know where they are in this. I haven't seen much from Congress on the control it could exert over these actions in Venezuela.
Mike Thompson, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Thompson is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. And that's our conversation for today. I hope that it served you. Don't forget that the legislative session has started, and you might want to head over to the SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies podcast if you like state politics and you want to hear all the latest from our analysts there. You can search for it on your favorite podcast platform, and you can find all of SDPB's coverage on our website, sdpb.org, or go right to sdpb.org/SD Network. From everyone here at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.